Ready to go. Excellent. So, first of all, welcome everybody and welcome to myself for this retreat. There is the water going down, but that is okay. Please do not worry about collecting water. Okay, could you put this over here? Otherwise, apparently I did hear there is a water shortage in Sri Lanka, which is the reason why there is rolling power cuts. So I've come here not just to teach meditation, to solve the water problem in Sri Lanka, so that many people will benefit. So, the purpose of this retreat, so I was told, was to teach some meditation instructions so that people can benefit from the meditation which I've learned and practiced. In particular, the ability to use the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths in particular as a guide to one's practice of bhavana. And I base my teachings on what I've learned from a master such as Ajahn Chah, from what I've learned from the teachings of the Buddha in the suttas, and also what I've experienced for myself. So those three strands of authority, personal experience, the word of the Buddha, and also the instructions of my teacher. So one of the first things I'm going to mention is from Ajahn Chah, because he would teach again and again and again and again that we meditate not to get something, but to let go of things. So we don't come here to attain either the nimitta stage or the jhanas or stages of enlightenment. We come to let go of the obstacles to nimittas, to jhanas, to enlightenment. You may think that that's a small thing, but that changes the whole of one's attitude to meditation. We come here to renounce, to let go, to see things vanish, rather than to attain more encumbrances, more attachments to our sense of self. So we're here to let go of things. And if we want to let go of things, we must go in an opposite direction to wanting things. And you all know that the second noble truth taught by the Buddha was that dukkha is the cause of dukkha, suffering. And sometimes that in Western translations, we render the word, we translate the word dukkha as craving. But I was never happy with that translation, as it only included the more extreme forms of wanting. And just small little wants, even what we may call noble aspirations, were excluded as a cause for suffering. And certainly in my own experience, and in the experience which I gathered from an Ajahn Chah, even small amounts of craving, even wanting good things, are also a cause for suffering. And you may recall, as an example, the story of the Lord Buddha's enlightenment, where under the Bodhi tree, Mara tried to stop the Buddha attaining Sammasambuddho or Sammasambodhi, full enlightenment, by offering him the abilities to change the world, to help solve things like corruption, poverty, conflict, wars, disharmony, to be the world-turning monarch so that humanity would not need to suffer. Even though that is a noble aspiration, even the Buddha realized that such aspirations are not the cause for ending suffering, but for prolonging suffering. Even small amounts of wanting are a cause of suffering. And so for many years now, I have rendered the word tanha as any type of wanting, even wanting for good things, and especially during one's meditation. If you want to become peaceful, you will never find peace. If you want to even be aware of your breathing, you will never really be able to achieve it for that long. If you want nimittas, jhanas, if you want so on, it will always be a long way away from you. These are the things which occur when you let go, renounce all wanting. If wanting is the cause of suffering, then the third noble truth, letting go of wanting, is the cause for the arising of Nibbana. People sometimes think if you need to get anywhere, you need to want. Otherwise, nothing happens. However, my experience is that the opposite happens. When you want, when you aspire for any type of attainment on the path, it just puts off that attainment. It delays it. It is the cause for those experiences not arising. Instead, we need to still let go of all of our wants. Now, this may be a simple simile, but it explains what I mean in a way that you can all understand. And it is a simile of a 1,000-petaled lotus, which is a symbol of Buddhism. And a lotus flower is closed up at night time. And if you look at a lotus flower when it is closed up, its outermost sheath, the outermost layer of petals, is rough, thick, coarse, and often dirty, because it has to endure the rain and the wind, the cold and the heat. It protects what's inside the lotus. And you also know, in the early morning, when the sun rises, that the first warmth and light of the sun hitting the outermost petal of the lotus makes it open up. It opens slowly, gradually, because of the warmth and the light, and reveals the next layer of petals in the lotus. And the next layer of petals inside of a lotus are more refined. They are not as thick, and they have some fragrance. They are more attractive. But once the outermost layer has opened up, it allows the warmth and the light of the sun to hit the next layer of petals so that they can open up as well. And that is how a lotus opens up, layer by layer by layer. This layer opens up because of the warmth and light of the sun, allowing the next layer to receive the warmth and light of the sun and eventually open up itself. So the layers open up one by one only because of the warmth and the light of the sun. In that simile, the lotus is your body and mind. And I have taught this meditation to many people. And some of the people I've taught this meditation to are the most unlikely candidates to get any depth in their meditation. And in particular, about 2 years ago, when I was starting a meditation retreat in Australia, in Perth, a gentleman came to register for my retreat. This gentleman was an Australian, maybe about 6'3" or 6'4", covered with tattoos. and a few, I think, piercings. He looked more like a Hell's Angel than somebody who was going to learn meditation. And I mistakenly judged him and told him that you've come to the wrong place, sir. There was a prison not far from my monastery. I said, the prison is up the road another 6 kilometers. At which point, he said, no, I'm not going to the prison. I've registered for this retreat. He gave me his name and he was on the list. So I was embarrassed judging a person just from their looks. But later on during that meditation retreat, when I gave the interviews for everybody, he came to his interviews and started describing some of his experiences in meditation. And when I was listening to his experiences, you wouldn't say I was surprised, I was shocked. Because what he described was what I clearly recognize as the first jhana. And this most unlikely meditator had followed all the instructions and had gone through all of the preliminary stages. And when he was saying his experiences and I was questioning him, I could only tell him afterwards, sir, you have just experienced the first of the jhanas, one of the Uttarimanusa Dhammas, the very high states available to the human beings, as a lay person, as an upasaka, as someone whose lifestyle I thought was not conducive, at least his appearance was not conducive, to such an attainment. And that was where I used the example of the 1,000-petal lotus. The outermost petal is rough. The outermost petal may have tattoos, may look rough, but you should never underestimate what is inside of that lotus. Beautiful, beautiful petals. Nimittas, jhanas, enlightenment experiences, everything is inside you. So, looking at the Dharma with that type of perception means that your job in meditation is to open up your body and mind. But the most important part of this metaphor is the means by which your body and mind opens up. The light and the warmth of the sun represents the mindfulness, the awareness, that's the light, and the warmth represents some kindness. Both of those two have to happen together to open up this thing which we call our body and mind. And also, that metaphor serves the purpose that the next stage of these meditations are right inside the stage which you're experiencing now. So, for example, you take the stages of Anapanasati. You take, say, the third stage of Anapanasati, which is experiencing the hold of the breath, Sapakaya Pati Sangvedi. Inside of that stage, you will find the calming of the breath. Inside of that, you will find the experiencing the piti and then the sukha. They lie inside the stage which you are experiencing now. It is an important point, because you do not need to push aside the experience which you are having right now in order to step forward to the next stage. The Eightfold Path is not Anapanasati is not a ladder. It's not you go up from one step to another step, and to go up to the next step you have to let go, abandon, kick away the step you're standing on right now. The metaphor of a ladder in Anapanasati is not accurate. It's more the metaphor of the lotus, or sometimes I have used the metaphor of Russian dolls. where the next door is right inside the one which you can see right here. That is my experience of how I understand the different levels of meditation. The next level is inside the one you're experiencing now. So for goodness sake, do not throw away, do not have aversion or negativity to whatever you're experiencing. Have this mindfulness and kindness to what you're experiencing. Let this moment be. And it does not stagnate. It develops and goes inside to the next level of meditation. So one of the, what I understand from feedback, one of the defining features of the type of meditation which I teach is not wanting, not willing to go deeper into the meditation, but rather restraining that wanting, restraining that will, restraining, just letting go of all of that activity so that the mind can become still and develop into very, very deep states of meditation. And it's also a simile which I remember reading and now understanding again from my first reading of it from the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, when, before he even sat under the Bodhi tree, that he put his bowl in the river Nirmala and made an adhisthana: if my bowl flows against the stream, then it means I have the paramita, the spiritual qualities to become enlightened. And it says it flew against the stream. Now, I first understood that it went in the opposite direction. If I remember correctly, if you stand on the banks of the Nirmala River on the Bodh Gaya side, the river flows from left to right. So if I imagine the stream flowing from left to right, he would say that the bowl flows the opposite direction from right to left against the stream. But I really now understand that to mean against all streams. Stand still. Doesn't move at all. That is flowing against all streams of wanting and not wanting. Being perfectly still. That was for me another metaphor, indication of the path towards enlightenment. So when it comes to one's meditation, simile of the thousand petal lotus and how a lotus opens up is helpful. And a simile of what we need to do in order that the mind will become still is very much not a willpower, but a holding off, a letting go, a saying no, being still. And of course, this also comes from my understanding of the meaning of the word samadhi. Again, over 100 years ago, there was a British district officer, Rhys Davids, who did the first translation of the Pali into English. And when he went back to UK, to England, and used his knowledge of Pali, which he gained while he was a district officer here in Sri Lanka, he used that to get a position in the university to do Pali studies. And not having much assistance, he had to somehow translate these words into English. And it was Professor Rhys Davids who coined the word mindfulness, which was a stroke of genius. That is a very accurate translation of that word. But when he came to samadhi, he translated it as concentration, which I think was a big mistake and has caused a lot of problems for people's meditation in not only the West, but even here in Sri Lanka. My understanding is that it does not mean concentration at all, that it means stillness. And I have been teaching that for so many years because that comes again from my teacher Ajahn Chah, my own experience, but also now being a monk who travels internationally, that I do come across scholars of different traditions, and they have remarked to me that in the Chinese Agamas, which are the equivalent of our Sutta Pitaka, where you find many of our suttas have been translated into Chinese, and almost word for word the same, only the translation they have for samadhi in the Agamas in Chinese always means stillness, never anything to do with concentration. It seems those early scholars, many centuries ago, who would have used some of the advice of scholars in places like Sri Lanka, where they studied, where they got these scriptures from, that they at that time would also translate the word samadhi not as concentration, but as stillness. And if one can understand that samadhi, if you like, the goal of meditation, is stillness, not concentration. Stillness, not concentration. Then you will understand why effort, trying, wanting, goes in the opposite direction. You have to want, try, work hard to concentrate. But if you want to be still, letting go, renouncing, abandoning, those are the things which lead to stillness. Wanting can lead to concentration. Letting go leads to stillness. So, you may try, if you like, this method and see if it works for you. When you are sitting down, you close your eyes, you are aware, you are kind, but you don't want anything in the whole world. You are happy to be here. You are letting things be. You are renouncing your sense of self, which always drives this wanting process. You are just watching this body, first of all, the outermost leaf of this lotus, watching it, being aware, and being kind to it. And the kindness to your body means that you sit in a comfortable position. Fortunately, we have a few chairs here. That man who got into jhanas in my retreat with the tattoos, he spent most of his time sitting on a chair. He was an Australian, not used to sitting on the floor, because it was comfortable for him. You do not need to sit full lotus, half lotus on the floor in order to gain these jhanas. You can experience them in all sorts of postures. One experience, personal experience I had, of course I have to be very careful what I say because of the eighth paditya, which many of you should know, means I cannot claim any Uttari Manusa Dhamma, of which jhanas are one. I cannot claim in public, when there are lay people around, Uttari Manusa Dhamma when they're true. If I claim them when they're false, that you know is a parajika offence. But when they're true, it's still an offence for me, a paditya, the eighth paditya in our monk's Vinaya. So I'm hamstrung, so I usually just talk about deep meditation, which has enough doubt in it to what I mean, that I can use that as a loophole to get out of creating any offence. But this was a time I think only maybe 1 or 2 years as a bhikkhu in northeast Thailand, when I, like many of my fellow monks at the time, contracted the disease called scrub typhus, whose symptoms are almost the same as typhoid. And because the health authority there believed that there was no such thing as scrub typhus in that part of Thailand, they did not know what they were treating me for. Later on, 2 or 3 years later, so many of the Western monks developed scrub typhus, at least the symptoms of it, that eventually that they suspected it may be that disease, they sent the health teams from Bangkok to do a test in that forest, and they did find in that forest the small mite, the tiny insect whose bite would transmit the scrub typhus. The reason they did not realize it existed was because the local community of villagers had developed a natural immunity to that disease. And it was only when the foreigners came in, whether they were Sri Lankan monks or Burmese monks or Westerners, we hadn't got that immunity, the locals did, and that's why it hadn't surfaced for so many decades. But anyway, a disease like scrub typhus, a very heavy fever for about 3 or 4 weeks, which did not abate because of they did not know what antibiotics to give, it meant that I was incredibly low energy. In those days, the hospital wards were a row of beds on either side, and we did not have bedpans. There was one toilet at the end of the ward, and to get there, I had to hold on to the metal end of the beds. I remember this clearly, holding on to support myself because I could not hold my own weight up because I was so weak with the fever, and we never had any support, no nurses. And so I had to build up my energy and literally lurch, which means like almost fall, jump to the next bed and grab on to get my energy up to do to the next stage, which is go to the next bed. And it took a long time to go bed to bed holding on because I was so weak to get to the toilet. And once I was in the toilet, I made sure I stayed there long enough to do every business possible because I wasn't going to do this many times a day. That is an example, without exaggeration, of how weak I was. And I also remember one day, this is for those of you who want a little bit of entertainment, this is where Ajahn Chah came to see me. And Ajahn Chah, this great monk, my teacher, and I was only a very small monk at the time, and I was so honored that this really important monk would come to see me, that for a few seconds when I saw him come into the ward to see me, oh, I felt so happy, so uplifted, I felt better. Until he came to see me and started giving me his advice. What he said to me was not what I wanted, but it was what I needed. What he said to me was, Brahma Wangso, you will either get better or you will die. And then he left. You cannot argue with such wisdom, only it wasn't what I wanted. So, there you were, alone, well, with other Thai monks who were equally sick, you might as well be alone. Feeling awful, feeling terrible, getting negative, until I remembered I was a bhikkhu, a disciple of the Buddha. So, why don't I meditate, practice anapanasati, even when I was very, very low energy? And I found, yes, you can do that. Even when you are sick, you are breathing, you have something to watch, so you could very gently focus your awareness on your breath. And soon, because I've been practicing this for years and had some skill in this area, soon you could focus on your breathing and you could not feel the rest of the body. And soon the breath became very delightful and all the aches and pains were vanishing. And soon you got into a really deep meditation whose stages I cannot tell you, otherwise I get into trouble. A very deep meditation for a long time, which was so blissful because it was compared with the sick body which I experienced when I came out. But the reason I tell that story was not to promote any of my personal abilities. It was that I immediately looked at my position. The position of my body when that state arose. But I've never seen that position in any meditation book, anywhere in any country. You are laying on the bed, not in your right side in the lion pose, which was recommended in Theravada Buddhism. One leg was sticking one way, one leg another, an arm this way, another arm that way. It was the most unlikely position of a human being's body to get into deep meditation, but I knew I'd just been in a deep meditation, and so I concluded, your bodily posture, the way you hold your body, is not that important. So sitting on a chair, using cushions and stools, is no impediment to the practice of meditation. Maybe in Sri Lanka, in public, you may gain some more respect when you sit on the floor. But in your own Aranyas, monasteries or kutis, please sit as comfortably as possible where your body feels relaxed. So this I'm now going to expand on is what I mean by the warmth and the light of the sun, the mindfulness and kindness on the first layer of petals, which is your body. So when I close my eyes to meditate, the first thing I do is to be aware of my physical posture. How are my legs? How's my bottom? How's my back? My shoulders? My arms? My head? I check my posture methodically. That is awareness. And I'm also kind. This is the light and the warmth of the sun. I'm kind enough to say my legs need adjusting. So I adjust them. The advantage of mindfulness, one of the reasons why it becomes a therapy in many Western countries is it allows you to get feedback. When you're aware of the physical body and I move it, I can feel immediately whether that's improved or whether that's more uncomfortable. It's called feedback. So working on feedback, I can move it this way, that way, until I can find the best position, just from my legs. And finding the best position is just kindness. Awareness gives you feedback. The kindness doesn't stop until your body is comfortable. My bottom, my back. And one of the things which is obvious, but which I have discovered and I want to let you know too, is that every meditation the posture is slightly different. Depending time of the day, how much you've eaten, whether it's warm, whether it's cold, your body will change. And so never think that this is my position of the body. I'm going to stick to it no matter what. If you're sick, you may have to lie down. If you're tired because you've been walking a lot, maybe you have to adjust your legs in one particular posture which you don't need when you've just been resting all day. So, don't ever assume that the way you hold your body will be the same in every meditation. So mindfulness and kindness finds the best posture for your body. And don't think that that is just too basic for you. Because it's not only getting a good posture, it's not just mindfulness and kindness on the lotus, it's also developing those two qualities of awareness and kindness on the body so they get stronger and stronger at every stage of this meditation, starting with your body. And the next thing which I do is something which I have developed, I don't think I taught this in the last retreat I gave in Bandaruwela, is actually using this to go deeper into your body, especially to help heal physical ailments. I've had great success with this. Even recently, that I was got an email from a lady in Poland. And this lady had been listening to my talks on YouTube and also my meditation instruction, which is freely available. She was elderly and was suffering from very severe arthritis, for which she needed very strong painkillers, which she had to take many times a day just so she could exist. Her pain was extreme. And I've seen many people crippled with arthritis, arms bent, legs bent, because of that disease which affects one's joints. Not only that, the painkillers had very nasty side effects, but she had no choice. She had to take those just to manage the extreme pain which comes with arthritis. And in her email she said that through this method of meditation, which I'm now going to describe, that she completely cured her arthritis, does not need any more painkillers at all, because there's no more pain, no more arthritis. Which to me was the first time, and she said, thank you, the first time that I've ever heard that arthritis can be cured. I've cured lesser things than arthritis with this little method. I did mention in many talks, and I think you probably heard this, that once in my monastery in Australia, I had food poisoning. And food poisoning, I'm sure, I imagine that many of you monks have had that, because you do not know what you're eating. And sometimes the hygiene is less than you would want, especially eating Bindapata food. And so I call stomach aches an occupational hazard for a monk. It just happens to us, more than lay people, who have more control over their diet. So I was in Bodhinyana Monastery in Perth, in the cave where I live, screaming in pain. It was involuntary. When you have food poisoning, you have these contractions, you know, in your intestines or bowels. And when you have those contractions, it's automatic. You cannot stop it. Ow! Ow! Oh! Now, the reason why I went through that little bit of drama is also because I want to encourage many of you not just to know meditation, but also how to give dana, especially to lay people. Every time you do something like, ah! people actually become awake, they start listening again, and many people find it entertaining. In other words, they start listening. So for goodness sake, when you are giving bhana, don't just give a very accurate discourse with no ads or oohs to keep people alert. It's just teaching people how to teach. And it works, because many of you just started paying attention again. So, there I was, in agony, thinking, what should I do next? Now, where we live, we don't have mobile phones, and not in our monastery. We have a landline, and if I did manage to crawl to the office, it would probably be locked anyway. Or if you did try and call an ambulance, which is what most people would do with food poisoning, by the time they arrived, because we were at least 30-40 minutes from the hospital, I'd probably be dead anyway. So it's a waste of time trying to get an ambulance. We're too far away. And in Aranyas, that happens to us. We're too far away from the doctor sometimes. So we have to try something else. And of course, you're a monk, a bhikkhu, so I don't need an ambulance. I'll sort this out myself. Mindful, aware of the pain, which means not trying to get rid of it, not trying to escape from it, not trying to find some place I can focus on where I don't feel that pain. Not running away, but running towards. Being with that pain as much as I possibly could. And next, adding the kindness, the compassion to that pain. That is something which many of you may have experienced. What happens when you give compassion to physical pain? I first learned this when I was growing up as a poor kid in London. My father was sick. My mother was just a typist in a pool. We lived in what was called a council flat. Not even a council house. This was one down from a council house. A council flat. Government subsidized cheap housing. And I loved playing soccer like many of my friends. But where we played soccer was in the street, on the tarmac, or on the stone of the paving bricks of the pavements. And so every time you go for a tackle in soccer, you fall over. And I have vivid memories of my knees as a young boy, maybe 7 to 11 or 10, always with scabs, dried blood on them. Because I would go for a tackle and I'd graze the skin off my knees. And it would hurt and it would be bleeding. And I would straight away run to my mother. And she would kneel down and kiss it. And every time that took the pain away. As a young boy, not really knowing much about science, I thought that was normal, that was natural. But now I realize it is normal and natural, but many people miss the fact that kindness can actually take away a lot of pain. It relaxes those muscles. And I know now this is one of the reasons why in hospitals that the kindness of a doctor or a nurse, or if you are sick in your monasteries, the kindness of an attendant monk, it's not just doing a service which is very limited, but it also can help take away much of the physical pain of that disease or injury. A little bit of kindness. Of course, you understand how that works. The kindness gives some relaxation. The relaxation takes away some of the inflammation, the tightness, which stops the blood going to the place. It also stimulates endomorphins, which go into the blood, nature's painkillers, and immune system repressants, immune system enhancers. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't go so fast. You're writing it down. It's okay. It's just the kindness. I think I'm not quite sure it's, I think, endorphins or endomorphins, so sometimes I get that wrong. Is it endorphins? Endorphins, yes. Endorphins, which is a chemical which is secreted into the blood, which actually lessens the pain and improves your immune system. So, I used kindness on my intestines. Just giving them metta, loving kindness. As monks, nuns, we are supposed to train in sharing loving kindness to all sentient beings. I did it on my guts. It's not that hard to do. And my awareness, my mindfulness, gave me the following feedback. Every time I gave it a blast of metta, the pain of that food poisoning got a little bit less. Not much less, but I was aware enough to notice the pain had reduced. So I gave it another blast of metta, noticing the pain reduced again and reduced again. And this was my meditation, giving food poisoning mindfulness and kindness, the warmth and light of the sun. And it only took me, it was an amazing 20 minutes. And there was no more contractions, no more food poisoning, no more pain. And my digestion was normal again. And that even surprised me. I got up and thought, wow, it's amazing just how we can use this meditation to actually overcome something like a food poisoning without needing to take any medication. Just by using the natural ability of the mind, the mindfulness and the kindness to relax things, to relax things. And that's how this lady overcame her, what's called arthritis. Please excuse me if I have to pause because I've just arrived from Australia, left yesterday I think, arrived 1 o'clock this morning because the aircraft was late. So I'm a little bit exhausted, but still good enough, I hope. So there we go, and travel of course from Colombo this morning to here, just arrived, 3 o'clock. So, this is how we use the mindfulness and kindness to actually relax our body. And there's nothing I have seen which cannot be fixed that way. A headache, a backache. Monks in Sri Lanka are often sick. And sometimes it's because, you know, we do live a long way away from hospitals and doctors. Sometimes we don't get checkups. Sometimes, you know, we live out in the jungles. Sometimes we do fall over and injure ourselves. It's too hard to get medical treatment. Maybe you can try that, mindfulness and kindness. But in particular, it can just relax the body so much that you're sitting here in meditation. I am now, I've had my 65th birthday last year in August. I'm getting old. My body starts to ache and get stiff. But when I start my meditation, I'm mindful and kind to my body. And I keep that up until my body feels so relaxed. So relaxed that it's like you've just been in a hot bath. I've never had a massage in a spa, but I'd imagine that that's what your body feels when you've had a good massage in one of these coastal hotels, resorts they have now in Sri Lanka where you can get body massages or spas. Why do especially foreigners pay so much money for that? Because they feel so good afterwards. Totally relaxed. Being a monk, I should never go to such a spa or resort. I haven't got the money anyway. None of my dharmakas would sponsor that. But I don't need to. I could do that just sitting down here, just relaxing all of my body totally. When I relax a body like that, it's so easy, it actually happens by itself. It disappears. It goes. And the reason why it goes is because there's nothing happening there. There's no aches, no pains. no itches, no irritations. It goes, disappears. And for those of you who are getting old, please learn this technique. It allows you to sit, even if you have hay fever and itchy nose, indigestion, aches and pains anywhere in the body. It can just totally disappear, so you can let your body vanish. Go inside to the realm of the mind. Because quite frankly, if your body is aching, sick, pain, irritated, it's so difficult to get into deep meditation. Not impossible, but difficult. You're getting there watching your breathing and an ache in your knee comes up. You relax it, rest it, or you want to sneeze, or you get a backache. Oh, that's a disturbance to meditation. So by doing this, looking after your posture, learning how to relax the body, you can overcome a lot of problems in the body so that outermost petal can vanish and go inside to the realm of the mind. And the next stage is something I've developed over the last 1 or 2 years. And don't, again, as a bhikkhu who's probably gone way beyond this in your meditation already, don't just ignore this, because I found this very helpful. And also helpful when you teach some of your Dayaka's meditation. Because I've always noticed when people drive a car, because often I sit in the passenger seat, that they have all these dials on the dashboard of their car. These meters. One tells you how much petrol you have in the car. Another one tells you the temperature of the engine. And one of the most important ones is the speedometer, so you can tell how fast you are going. Those are meters on your dashboard. Now, the speedometer, you're watching the speedometer, and you press your foot on the accelerator, and you find the needle go up. It's giving you some feedback that you are pressing too hard. So you lessen the pressure on the accelerator pedal and you notice the speedometer goes down. That's how you can adjust that needle, that meter, just to the right speed so you don't get caught by the traffic cops, the speeding. Fortunately, we never saw any traffic cops on the way up here. We did actually, but driver Rohita, you never actually got caught. Maybe that's because the magic power of Venerable Metta Vihari and I keeping the speed cops away. So anyway, so that gives you feedback. Now, there are many meters in your jitta, in your mind. And the one I've been asking people to observe, to get to know, to recognize, to be mindful of, is something, for want of a better name, I've called the peaceometer. Not the speedometer, which shows you how much speed you have. Not the gasometer, no, it's not actually gasometer. The speedometer. Not the speedometer, but the peaceometer, which shows you how much peace you have in your mind. Sometimes that needle is way to the extreme. You're agitated, you're worried about something. You've been thinking a lot about, you've been planning Ajahn Brahm's retreat, poor Metta Vihari. You know, lots of business. So that makes you very agitated. Your needle is way to one end. And sometimes you're really peaceful, so it's the other end, the peaceometer. All it really is being aware, after your body disappears, are you dealt with the body, how peaceful are you? Or how agitated are you? And of course, it's always going to be different. For psychologists in the West, in order to get people to be aware of such things, they do a little trick. And that is asking yourself right now to give that peaceometer a number, a rating, from 1 to 10. If you feel you're really, really peaceful, give it a 1. Average, 5. Really agitated, disturbed, give it a 10. So, what number would you give your state of mind now? between peace and agitation from 1 to 10. Don't tell me, because that's not the point of the exercise. The point of the exercise is you to start to become aware of how peaceful or how agitated you are. And don't judge, oh, it's another 9 or 10 today, I'm a bad monk or a bad nun. It's not about judging, it's just about being aware. Because once you're aware, then see what happens if you do things like wanting something, striving, being negative because you don't want your mind to be like that. What does that do to the peaceometer? What happens when you let go? Just let it be. Opening the door of your heart to this moment. Renouncing all control. This is not me, not mine, not a self, none of my business. It's just the jitter, that's all. It can be whatever it is. I'm not taking personal ownership of this. I just let it be. Just like you watch the rain. Is the rain convenient or inconvenient? Doesn't really matter. You can't control it, so you just let it be. Your agitation or peace, just let it be. And then see what happens to that needle. The needle goes down. Goes to more peacefulness. What you're learning here, the mindfulness of the peaceometer, learns, teaches you how to relax and to get a basic level of peace for which you can start to do the rest of the meditation. Now, many meditators, both monks, nuns, and lay people, make a huge mistake of when they try to watch the breathing, their mind is not ready to watch the breath yet. There's not enough peace in their mind. So the only way you can watch the breath is through force. I'm going to watch my breath, breathe in, breathe out, breathe out. Don't miss any of them. You can do that through force, but that makes you very tense. And it's the opposite of the path of meditation. It does mean that you've tried to watch the breath too soon, without enough preparation. Or, instead of using force, I could just watch the breath, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in. I wonder what my family's doing. And you start wandering off far too quickly. The reason why you wander off or need to use force is because you didn't do the preparation right. When I do my preparation right, just the breath actually comes to me and it's easy to watch. No effort at all, not needed. Don't wander off because I've done the preparation. Make sure my mind is peaceful enough. It's ready to watch the breath. So I call that just the next level of meditation. Just enough peace, enough mindfulness. Well, the Buddha said in the Anapanasati Sutta, he said that not establishing mindfulness in front of you. Again, I don't like that translation. What does it mean, in front of you? For Westerners, or those who have been influenced by Western culture, which is now Sri Lanka, in front of me, where are you anyway? Here. I'm in my head somewhere. So mindfulness in front of me means up here somewhere. That's why people get the nose thing. But 100 years ago in Sri Lanka, and many other countries, people thought they were in here. This was the center of their awareness of their being. So for them, mindfulness in front of you means being mindful of here somewhere. But it doesn't mean physically in front. What it means in the Anapanasati Sutta is putting it at the top of the list, putting in front of everything else, giving it priority. The first thing to do is to give mindfulness priority. In other words, to establish enough mindfulness that it's ready to watch the breath. So don't just go looking at the breath first of all. The first priority, enough mindfulness, awareness. So you can actually watch the breath. You're ready for it. And this is one of the ways of doing that. Watching a peaceometer. And please, I've had great results with that with teaching lay people. Because after a while they get it. And they know they're just so agitated. They need just to relax first of all. Just to let things be. Don't try and make themselves more agitated by trying to watch the breath and failing. So just watch the peaceometer and get nice and peaceful and calm. And then they can start to watch the breath. This is going into the next layer of the lotus. And in the next layer of the lotus you can see the breath. Just breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. And where you watch the breath. Again, I already mentioned it never says in the Anapanasati Sutta you should watch the breath at the tip of the nose or in the belly. As many of you know, it's not nose meditation, it's not belly meditation, it's breath meditation. And there is a particular danger in watching the breath at the tip of the nose. I never watched the breath at the tip of the nose. I just watched the breath because I suffered from hay fever. Still do. And sometimes you watch the tip of the nose, there's no breath there at all. Because my nose is all stuffed up. There's no breath goes in and out there. Hay fever time. So that's what I learned. Even though I could not watch the breath at the tip of the nose, I certainly knew I was still breathing. I wasn't dead. I'm always breathing. So, how do I know I'm breathing? It was more like the knowledge of the breath. That which told me I was breathing in, that which told me I was breathing out, was all I watched. But, later on, when I went to, first of all, Malaysia to teach. Any Malaysian monks here? No Malaysian monks here. When I went to Malaysia to teach meditation, many of my students were complaining about samadhi headache. Meditation headache. And that was the first time I'd ever heard that word, meditation headache. All the years I was in Thailand, all the years before I'd been meditating, before I became a monk, I never heard that word. For me, meditation is what you did to relieve headaches, not to get them. So maybe about 6 months or a year, I couldn't find out why. Until I think somebody suggested this to me, and it was obvious once you understand why. If you meditate on the tip of the nose, if you put your mindfulness on the tip of the nose, it is just automatic. You don't realize you're doing this. But also your eyes go to the tip of the nose as well. And to demonstrate what I mean, I'm going to remove my glasses just for a few minutes, for a minute or so. And I am now going to meditate on the tip of the nose, but with my eyelids up, with my eyes open. Because if I start focusing on the tip of my nose, my eyes go to the tip of the nose too. And I don't know if you're near enough to see me, but I'm now going very cross-eyed. Both eyeballs are just moving into the tip of the nose. And that is often what happens when you're meditating on the tip of the nose without realizing it. Your mind is watching the tip of the nose, but underneath your eyelids, your eyeballs are also focusing in. Which is why you get tension headaches above your eyes. Simply because you're focusing. Not just with your mind, but with your eyes. They're just too connected together. It does it automatically. So be careful of watching at the tip of the nose. You'll find often, for too long, you might get headaches. But it doesn't actually mean that. It just means watching the breath. And I'll talk about more about the next stages of meditation later. I've got many more talks to give. And if I run out of material, it's going to be very difficult by the end of the week. So, that is enough for now. I'll quickly summarize what happens later, because many are way beyond this. But what happens later is you can see the breath. It just comes up, breathing in, breathing out. You don't do anything. You don't try to get to the next stage, the next step of Anapanasati. Just after a while, because you're watching the breath, just in and out, a very still, peaceful thing to do, your mindfulness increases. By which I mean you can see more of what's going on. It's not you just see in and out. You see from the very beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath. You see the space between the in-breath and the out-breath. You see from the out-breath to the end of the out-breath, beginning to end. That is the sabbakaya, padisangvedi. Kaya does not mean your body. I know some monks still say that. And if you look at Anapanasati Sutta, he said the breath is a body amongst the bodies. It counts as a body. It means a body. This is watching the whole breath from beginning to end, not watching your toes while you're breathing in. So you're watching the whole breath from beginning to end. It happens naturally. As your awareness increases in its power, it sees more of the breath. and you experience such stuff as there's never ever two breaths which are exactly the same. Every breath is absolutely different. Like every blade of grass you may see in this compound, there's no two exactly the same. I don't know, millions of blades of grass here. Millions of breaths you've taken. No two are the same. You're aware enough to notice that. And naturally you don't do this. This is another layer of petals, a full breath. And then it calms down by itself. It's very soft and very peaceful. Just breathing in, breathing out. If you do it properly, the mindfulness increases with every stage. It gets stronger. In the morning, the sun actually grows in intensity. It becomes brighter and lighter. That's what happens with mindfulness. So you can see more of the breath. And it becomes just the whole body of the breath. And of course, the next stage, going in, it becomes very delightful. The piti and the sukha along with the breath. But I'll talk about that later on. And this is enough for the moment. To learn how to be mindful of your body. And then mindful of the jitta, the peaceometer. How that fits in with the rest of the Buddhism. That is the first three satipatthanas. Mindfulness of the body, your posture, mindfulness of the feelings, how comfortable it feels. Finding the causes and effects. That is what, in English, they say the rising and passing away. It doesn't mean up and down, it means why. That is in the Satipatthana Sutta, Sutta number 42. I know that Sutta 42, in the Satipatthana Sangyutta, the arise and fall explanation, because I'm now 42 years as a monk. So that's how I know 42 wasa. That's it. Satipatthana Sangyutta number 42 is where you'll find what it means. By the rise and fall in Satipatthana. It's the causes. You understand what's the cause for the body to be tranquil and why the body is painful. The feelings, let's say the cause for the sukha vedana and dukkha vedana in your own body while you're meditating. And what you understand that cause, developing a very peaceful, happy body, content body. And then also part of chit. To the Citta Satipatthana, the third Satipatthana. The way the Buddha describes it, the way it's described in the commentaries, is always had the knowing the mind in jhana or knowing the mind with one of the hindrances. Those are like extremes of the peaceometer. But it's also, I understand, interpreted as meaning an every level in between the jhanas and being in the hindrances. And I just call it a peaceometer. To bring it to an understanding which everybody can comprehend. How peaceful is your citta? How agitated is it? How many hindrances? How much of those hindrances overcome? The peaceometer. And in every of those satipatthanas, you know, is also the cause and effect. The arising, passing away. That's what it is explained as, but it doesn't mean that. You can check for yourself Satipatthana 42. What is the arising of these things? What is this passing away? See those things, the causes. And that gives you how to understand, how to create a peaceful enough citta so you can actually start to do the samadhi. Satipatthana often precedes samasamadhi. Samasati, a cause for samasamadhi. That's one of the reasons. Simple meditation technique. Body awareness, Vedana awareness, Citta awareness, to get into a state where you're ready to watch the breathing. So I think that's enough for today.